Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We are thrilled to be joined today by James Renner. James is an investigative journalist, true crime author, novelist, podcaster, film director, founder of the Porchlight Project. James, you've done a little bit of everything, and we appreciate your time talking to us today.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on.
Did I leave out any big titles that you've had? Did I hit most of the highlights?
I think you got the highlights. The other thing that I've been doing since about 2019 is this nonprofit called the Porchlight Project, which raises money for DNA testing and genetic genealogy for cold cases in Ohio. And that's going better than I expected. You know, we got really lucky out of the gate and helped the Cuyahoga Falls police track down the killer of Barbara Blatnick. And she was a teenage girl who was abducted from Garfield Heights, Ohio in 1987. And her body was found in the woods, is technically in Cuyahoga Falls, which is about 30 minutes away from Garfield Heights, and they hadn't been able to figure it out. And so I helped them connect with some labs, and we got them genetic genealogists, and they were able to make an arrest in that case in 2020. And since then, we've identified a number of John Does, and we have a couple cases we're working on now that are getting really close. So.
Awesome.
When you say that through that work, you've identified some John Does, are they able to put those into CODIS so that eventually maybe there could be more potential matches based on your work?
I think so. We identified a Jane Doe case out of Sandusky last year. What's interesting about those cases is many of them are victims of murder. And they don't really even know where to start until they figure out who the victim is, you know. So it's really kind of one half of the mystery. Now we've been able to tell them who their victim is. Now it goes back to police to try to track down their families and figure out who had the means, motive, and opportunity to kill them.
Gotcha. So the people that you've identified are primarily victims. So CODIS really a moot point because they are the victim of the crime and not the potential perp.
Right. Yes. But we have done a couple of suspect cases where, you know, like with the Barbara Blatnick case, I would assume that his DNA is now in CODIS, you know, because it is the one murder that he's been linked to. But, you know, when you do something like that, it's hard to imagine it's the only time you've ever done it.
There's going to be breaking news in our part of the country soon, and I'm not at liberty to discuss that, but because of DNA work, there is a case that is solved and there will be an arrest made forthcoming. And that's really all I can say about that right now.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's been a long week and we haven't spoken.
Gosh, you can't do that. Okay, we'll talk
about it. Is this a serial killer case or a one-off as far as they know?
It seems to be a one-off as far as they know right now, but I think it's incredible work that you're doing because there are so many of these backlogged cases that are just sitting there that need this kind of work. And it's really baffling to me why we just can't, as a country, say, you know, the national debt's 400 gazillion right now. Let's make it 500 and run all of these cases.
Right.
So. Right. Yeah. I'd like to see something like that. I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't do it. You know, the advances in the DNA databases are, I mean, it's really wild. I do think we're within 5 years of having, and maybe, you know, somewhere in the deep basements of the government, they already have this, but, you know, shortly, I think we'll be able to have a map to, you know, where every citizen kind of fits on it somewhere. And we see how everybody's related to everybody else.
Yeah.
I think kind of like a tree of human history.
Yeah. It's really interesting, and I think it's going to go a long way in helping us solve decades-old crimes. So,
is the best way to support the Porchlight Project through donations? Are there other ways to get involved?
Okay. Yeah. We have a online, if you just search Porchlight and
we'll put the links in the show notes.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. I think it's porchlightonline.org, but yeah. People send us, you can donate online. People send us $5, $10, $50, $100, and it all adds up.
Right. Yeah. Every little bit helps. And to have that success early on, I mean, it's something that I think has grown, at least in notoriety, and people are well aware of it. You said you founded it to specifically focus on Ohio. Have you worked outside of Ohio with the Porchlight Project, or are other states starting to jump in that as well?
Well, yeah, we're totally focused on Ohio. I think, there's certainly enough cases here to keep us busy forever, unfortunately. But we are working with police in Arizona right now on a case, only because the victim is from Talmadge, Ohio.
Okay.
So and I think we're getting close to an answer in that case.
A lot of the cases that I've followed you for are from Ohio. You grew up in Ohio. Growing up, what got you interested in crime enough to start investigating and writing about it?
Well, no doubt about it. It was the Amy Mihaljevic case. Amy Mihaljevic was a 10-year-old girl who was abducted from a shopping plaza in Bay Village, Ohio, in 1989. And Bay Village, for those unfamiliar with the area, it's on the west side of Cleveland, and it's a small little town by Lake Erie, and beautiful big houses. It's where a lot of doctors live, actually where a lot of FBI agents live, and it's considered one of the safest neighborhoods in greater Cleveland. But this girl was abducted from a shopping plaza October 27th, 89. In broad daylight on a Friday afternoon across the street from the police station. So it was such a wild case. It was, for my generation, it's that case that kind of woke us up as kids. And, we realized that we live in a dangerous world. And probably the reason I was so interested in it is because Amy and I were the same age. We were both born in 1978. And when she went missing, back then I'd ride my Huffy 2-speed bike around the neighborhoods, and her picture was on every telephone pole. And I, even at age 11, I became kind of obsessed with trying to figure out who took her.
Yeah.
And it was never solved. Eventually her body was found in Ashland County. It's like 3 months later, in February of 1990. And, but they've never been able to identify the killer.
Yeah, that's how we first connected with you, and we were going to have an episode about that case, and we're super grateful to have your input. And you've written a book about the case, and obviously still following it, so people should go check out your book. We don't have time for all those details today, but do you think it can be solved? I know you have a list of suspects that you've unearthed and some other ideas, but yeah, are we going to figure it out?
Yes, one day I think we'll figure it out. Absolutely. I think it's going to take, I think it'll probably be genetic genealogy that eventually solves the case. That case is a little tricky, though, because the DNA that they've found so far are three human hairs that were found on her body when she was found in the field in Ashland County. And the DNA, if you think of DNA like this, ladder with 1,000 rungs, right? Then the DNA that they found from those hairs was degraded. So the best, they'd have like chunks of like 3 or 4 rungs.
Yeah.
So what you can't, like, if you've got a suspect in mind, you can compare his DNA to the DNA the degraded DNA. And it'll be enough to like rule some people out, because if they don't have that section of DNA, then we know it's not them. But it's not enough to like definitively confirm that that person is the person who left that hair yet, because there's just not enough to match. But DNA advances all the time, and maybe they can retest it and get a better readout eventually, if they haven't done so already.
It really is crazy what they're able to do with DNA. My son has a medical issue, and he was able to just take like a piece of saliva, and it showed us everything. And it's just fascinating what we can learn off some level. So I would bet that in the future and not so distant future, we'll have that kind of technology.
I think so. I think so. It's a frustrating case. The police did everything they could. The one issue, another issue with that case is there are so many people, so many men that had the means, motive, and opportunity to commit the crime. Yeah. And the best the FBI has ever been able to do is narrow down the list of suspects to a top 25.
Yeah,
I mean, there were that many men that, could be linked to the crime. And, you know, I feel that over the years, I've whittled that number down to what I consider the top three. But there's not, I'm not 100% sold on any one of them. It's also possible that one man, more than one man, was involved in this crime. The back to the hairs that they found on her body, according to the genetic genealogist who took a look at them, each of those hairs comes from a different male, which could mean transfer DNA, like we've seen in the Long Island serial killer case, where the body picks up hairs by being transported in a car. So like the killer might've had his buddy in a car, you know, a week before then. And he lost, we're losing hairs all the time. And when she was transported in the car, it could have picked up one of those hairs. So it doesn't necessarily mean that those hairs are from the killer, but somebody close to the killer. Or it could mean that one, more than one person was involved. And that might explain why some of these suspects have an alibi for the kidnapping, and some of them have an alibi for when the body was dumped. And the more time goes by, the more I wonder if that might not be the case with this one, with Amy's case. It's certainly a possibility, because some of the suspects, some that are in the top, they did know each other and hung around the same places.
Yeah, always fascinated by that one, and certainly one that I try to look up updates for whenever I can. So hopefully, hopefully there will be some big ones.
Let's switch gears just a little. I know you've wrote another book called Little Crazy Children.
And yeah.
The title intrigues me. Tell me a little bit more about this book.
Sure. The title comes from the book, The Crucible. And when I was researching this case, it reminded me a lot about the Crucible, which is about the Salem witch trials. And I think the quote from The Crucible is something like, we are as we always were as children, but now we are as we always were in Salem, but now the little crazy children are holding the keys to the kingdom. And the case that the book is about is the unsolved murder of Lisa Pruitt from 1990, Shaker Heights, Ohio, which Shaker Heights, Ohio is on the east side of Cleveland, very similar to Bay Village in a lot of ways, because it's upper class, upper middle class, at least, and the home of many doctors and lawyers and professionals, and not the type of place where you would normally see a crime like this, which makes it stand out. What happened was Elisa was 16 years old. This is September 13th, 1990, and it was a great day for her. She just got her driver's license that day, and she was just reunited with her boyfriend because he had been away for a month, a little more than a month, in a psychiatric unit. So he gets out, they meet up, they make plans for her to sneak out of her house around midnight that night, and she was going to bike over to his house, which is at the corner of these roads, Lee and South Woodland, which is, Lee is kind of a major road that goes through Shaker Heights. And that's what she did. She snuck out. She rode her bike over to this her boyfriend's house, which is a mansion. At the time, his father worked for, I believe it was the Cleveland Clinic. And so about 12:30 at night, some of the neighbors hear a girl screaming. The police are called, and they find Lisa's body in the backyard of the property next to her boyfriend's house. And she's been stabbed, I think, 22, 23 times. It pierced her heart, I believe. By the time the police found her, there's no saving her. And So pretty good suspect with the boyfriend, right? She's found about 100 feet from his back door on the day he gets out of the psychiatric unit. And there's a, you know, a lot of red flags there. But then the day after the murder, a number of the boyfriend's friends and Lisa's friends, they go to the police and they say, hey, it can't possibly be the boyfriend. He's such a nice guy. He'd never do this. It has to be the weird kid in school, this guy, Kevin Young. And, you know, he listens to Metallica. He wears black. He plays D&D. And the police kind of fall for this and really go after Kevin, even though he has an alibi. He was playing video games with his father until like 1 a.m. that night. There's nothing from the crime scene that links him at all. They never found the murder weapon. And it just became this big media circus back then. Eventually, they did arrest him and try him for this murder, and he was acquitted in 1993. And but he was acquitted, but everybody to this day, not everybody, but if you go to Shaker Heights and you ask people who killed Lisa Pruitt, many of them will say, oh, it was Kevin Young. He just got a fancy lawyer and was able to get off. So over the years, I had written about this case a little bit when I was a reporter for Scene, which is kind of like our Village Voice newspaper up in Cleveland. And but there, I knew there was more to the story. So over the years, I began gathering all sorts of files, anything I could get through FOIA requests. And so I got files from the police department, from the city, from the prosecutor's office. And slowly I was gathering all this material in a couple boxes that I kept in my basement. And I kept telling myself one day I'll get to the book. I'll get to writing this book. And I just never got to that point until COVID hit. Mm-hmm. And I find myself locked, you know, in lockdown in my house with all the time in the world and nothing to do. So I opened those boxes and started going through the files with the intention of writing a book. And I had two goals. One, I wanted to clear Kevin's name in the court of public opinion. And two, I wanted to show that the boyfriend was a better suspect. Mm-hmm. What I didn't expect to find is a couple weeks into my research, all finding these police reports and evidence that points to, well, not just points to, but shows another young man was at the scene of the crime the night of the murder. And then I was able to link that man to two other homicides. So I believe that there is essentially a serial killer in Shaker Heights that was flying under the radar. And if the police hadn't been so focused on Kevin Young, they might have caught him back in 1990.
So I'm assuming that he's been caught, or is this still an unknown serial killer? Like, is he, well, I guess what I mean is, has he been arrested for other charges and still in jail?
He unfortunately died in 2017. He drank himself to death, but, I was able to, you know, their police files. So he kind of inserts himself into the investigation early on, you know, like some of them do.
Right.
The day after Lisa's murder, he goes to the police and says, hey, weird thing. I was at the, and by the way, he lives on the street behind where they found Lisa's body, mm-hmm. that runs parallel to Lee. So he's in the same little block. And he goes to police and he says, hey, I was at the bus stop today. And there was this black man there. And, you know, in Shaker Heights, if you say the word black man, you get the police's attention, you mm-hmm. know. That's what he's trying to do. He's like, there was this black guy at the bus stop, and he mentioned Lisa's murder, and he mentioned the murders of the Porters, which are the other two murders that happen on the same block mm-hmm. as Lisa's murder. And the boy said, I wonder if he is responsible for all three murders. And the police are like, what? You know, what a weird story. And the detective called him in and after thinking about it a while, and he's like, where were you the night of Lisa's murder? And he says, oh, I was on a date with my girlfriend, and then I dropped her off at her house. I think they were walking. Yeah. He dropped her off at her house and then walked back home. And his route back home from his girlfriend's house would have taken him right past the scene of the crime at around the same time. And in fact, he says when he came to the area, he saw two police officers and a search dog. And that search dog was not mentioned in the newspaper reports the next day. So the only way he could have known about it is to have actually seen it, like he says. But remember, those officers have just found a body. They're on high alert. This is now a homicide investigation. They never see him, but he sees them, which means he's hiding and watching these police officers. So he says he goes back home, talks to his mom. She's still up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and he takes a shower and goes to bed. They, of course, follow up with the mother, and she says, no, I wasn't awake. I don't know when he came in, you know, and took that shower, but I didn't see him until the next morning. He has a collection of knives that match the sort of knives that were used to kill her. He always has one on him. So all these things were stacking up. And then eventually I realized that he lives directly behind the house where these two other murders occurred. And I was able to link him directly to that scene the night of those murders too. Yeah. Oh, one other story about that. So like I said, he passed away in 2017. I'm writing this book in 2020. And so I reach out to his common law wife. He had a daughter with a woman in Twinsburg, and they were never married, but you know, they lived together for like 10 years. And I drove out to her house, to her apartment, and I figured she'd slam the door in my face and wouldn't want to talk about it. She was so nice. She invited me in and we got to talking. She talked about how whenever they drive through Shaker Heights, you know, he would point out, oh, that's where Lisa was found. And that's where the Porters were murdered. And he'd bring up the cases. And most people had forgotten about the Porters murders. So I asked her at the end of our conversation, I said, do you think it's possible that he murdered Lisa Pruitt? And she thought for a moment and she said, well, I'll tell you a story. When he was in preschool, one day a boy came and pushed him down on the playground. And he didn't fight back. He didn't punch the kid or anything. He didn't react at all. But when lunchtime came around, he made a point to sit next to this boy. And when the boy wasn't looking, he poured Comet cleaner in the kid's sandwich. She said that was him all of his. That's the type of person he was. She said, I wouldn't be surprised if he's responsible for all of those murders.
Wow. I was just wondering, sounds like you made a lot of these connections. Was this guy ever on the radar for Lisa's murder with police?
I know
they talked to him, but
yeah. I think the detective who interviewed him that first time must have suspected that he should at least be treated as a suspect. But beyond that, once they focused on Kevin, they got those blinders on and didn't want to look at anybody else. And in fact, right before Kevin's trial, the suspect that I believe is responsible, he's like I said, deceased. His name's Brannigan. And Brannigan's girlfriend went to the prosecutors and said, hey, you know, I understand you are treating me like I'm his alibi for when the murders occurred. That is incorrect. He would have had time to get to that scene and commit the crime that night. And the prosecutors just kind of shoot her away. They're like, no, we're going to trial with Kevin and we're not going to look at that right now. So there were a couple people that tried to, you know, tell the police and prosecutors that they've got the wrong man, but by then they were totally focused on Kevin.
And that goes back to the Crucible, right? This was a witch hunt. If you don't know what the Crucible is and you're listening to this, first of all, shame on your high school curriculum. Second of all, go check it out. There's also a movie, but yeah, so it's essentially like the witch hunt, right? Like they're so focused on Kevin. And one quote that I pulled out from you was that the psychologist actually said when they were interviewing Kevin and when they were going through the interrogations, here's how you clockwork orange Kevin. So they were so locked in on him, they were willing to fabricate and manipulate him as much as they could.
Oh yeah. I'm glad you brought out I'm glad that quote spoke to you, because I find that interaction so fascinating. You know, they consult with this psychologist out of Syracuse. His name's Dr. Murray Myron. And this guy was essentially a profiler. Mm-hmm. And they went to him because they were concerned that whoever killed Lisa would strike again. And they thought it was Kevin. So they were trying to really get a confession. And they were talking to him about a confession. And the psychologist, Murray Myron, he said, first of all, he says, the boyfriend's a much better suspect. Why aren't we talking about him? And they're like, we're locked in on Kevin. And he says, I think this is verbatim, too. And this was all recorded and logged. So we have the transcripts of this. The psychologist says, well, if it's Kevin or not, I guess that's academic. If he did it or not, here's how we get the confession.
Wow.
So he wasn't even interested in like the truth, but like he was telling the police, whether he did it or not, here's how you get your confession. And that's just that made me feel so bad for Kevin.
Do you think that's as prevalent now as it was then? You think we're getting to a place where people are so aware of false confessions or manipulation that that's going away? Or are we still approaching cases this way in law enforcement?
I think it's probably a little better, but you know, here in Cuyahoga County, which is the county of where Cleveland is, it's not much has changed at all. What, you know, because you have prosecutors in here that they have to be elected. And their whole platform is being tough on crime. So they overcharge in order to get plea deals, which counts as wins for them. And they do stuff like this just to assure that they'll win the case. You know, to them, the win is more important than the truth. Mm-hmm. It keeps them in office. It keeps everybody happy because you're getting all these convictions. But you're putting away a lot of innocent people, too. So unfortunately, at least here, it hasn't gotten much better.
Talk to me about, you have another book coming out in February, if I'm not mistaken. Can you talk a little bit more about what that project is?
I do. Yeah. I haven't talked about it yet. You're the first people that I've really discussed this with.
Are you okay with discussing
it? Of course. Yeah.
All right. Great.
Yeah. I'm an open book. So the book is called Scout Camp. And it comes out February 25th. You can pre-order it now. And it's through the same publisher that published Little Crazy Children. I'll be with them for a few books. And this is a very personal story. It took me, I'd say, about 20 years before I was comfortable sitting down and writing about it. But it's about the abuse scandal inside the Boy Scouts. And I think a lot of people don't have a sense of the scale of what happened inside the Boy Scouts. And it gets equated to the abuse inside the Catholic Church a lot. But the scale is exponentially greater. So with the Catholic Church, when the abuse scandal happened in the United States, there were 11,000 people, former, you know, altar boys and people associated with the church that ended up suing the Catholic Church in the United States. About 11,000. Recently, there was a class action suit against the Boy Scouts of America where 92,000 former Boy Scouts sued the organization.
Wow.
So it is exponentially greater than what happened in the Catholic Church. And the ramifications and the ripple effects from that are still being felt. It has changed the Boy Scouts have recently changed their name. I think just to, I forget what it's called now, just scouting or something like that, but they're taking the boy out of the Boy Scouts. Girls are now allowed in. There are a lot of women leaders. I think that's helping to change things, but there are a lot of victims. And so the book is about that, but it's also about the summer I worked as a camp counselor at Ohio's biggest Boy Scout camp, which is called Seven Ranges. And it's in Carroll County in kind of mid-eastern Ohio. And I was there in 1995. I was 17 years old. I spent the summer there as a counselor. I taught first aid, and it was the best and worst summer of my life. I made a lot of friends. But what happened about midway through the summer, one of the camp counselors sexually assaulted another one of the counselors, a friend of mine. And then got caught. and the next day was escorted out of camp, and he went home, and the next thing we know, he's dead. And we were first told it was a suicide, and then we were told it was an accident. He was we were told he shot himself, and then we were told he was shooting at cans in the backyard, and one ricocheted and killed him. But when you later on, years later, when I was working as a reporter, I pulled the autopsy file, and the death was labeled undetermined. And I spoke to the coroner, and he said it was undetermined because he could not rule out murder, that it was possible he was murdered. So that's the true crime at the center of this book, is what really happened to Mike Klingler. That was the guy's name. And, you know, was it suicide? Was it murder? Was it an accident? And I think I do get close to the answer for that, but it becomes a much bigger case. And so the book is interesting because it's me at like 45 years old trying to track down my old friends from 1995 and finding out how that summer changed our lives, and then trying to find the truth at the center of it. And so it was really going back into the past and learning about all that. And it's also, you know, what gets wrapped up in there and is partly responsible, I think, is there are secret societies within the Boy Scouts, and there are these special camp programs that happen at several summer camps. And at Seven Ranges, the society there is about 100 years old, and it's called Pipestone. And on Friday nights, the adults, some of the adult leaders and adults from surrounding communities come in and volunteer for this program. And they take kids out into the woods at around midnight, as young as 11 years old. And they put them through these very, culturally inappropriate Native American ceremonies. Oh. And when I was 11 years old and went through it, I thought these were real Native Americans in loincloths. But as you get older, you realize, no, they're just middle-aged white guys who have painted their skin red and wear nothing but these little loincloths. And you have to go through the ceremony where you like drink a bitter drink. And if you spit it out, you got to go back to the beginning of the line. And eventually you kneel down in front of the chief, and he's holding a human skull, and you have to look into the human skull to get the password for the next secret ceremony. And that first year password is secrecy. And then the chief at the end comes out and gives a speech about how to be better men, and how, you know, there are times where you need to keep secrets, sometimes even from your parents. And so what it was creating this culture of secrecy in a camp that, had an issue with abuse. And I think that secret society played a huge part in allowing some of this abuse to happen. But it was a wild ride. At one point I ended up testifying in front of the Ohio House. They were trying to pass a bill so that the victims of abuse could get the full amount that they deserved through this bankruptcy settlement with the Boy Scouts. And it did end up passing. So, you know, we got a win there. And it took me down some wild adventures writing that book, for sure.
That is mind blowing. And you referenced the Catholic scandal. That's something that's part of everyday conversation and pop culture, where people, whether appropriately or not, like reference or make fun of that, that idea. But to see that it's nearly 9 times more people that reported it in the Boy Scouts, something nobody talks about, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And you figure that, like, how many, what is, I wouldn't even know the percentage of how many people that were strong enough to report it versus how many people, you know, aren't reporting it or staying silent about it. So 92,000 is the number that came forward to sue the Boy Scouts, but how many more actually suffered abuse at some point?
And can you tell me the name of that book one more time?
Yeah, it's called Scout Camp.
Scout Camp.
I think the subtitle is Sex, Death, and Secret Societies Inside the Boy Scouts of America.
So that is coming out in February of 2025, if I'm not mistaken, and pre-orders are available now. I am going to pre-order that now. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, that's wild stuff. I think covering new ground is hard to do in a lot of these, and that seems like something that nobody else, or at least nobody that I found, is tapping into that that story. So, and it's so personal to you, so kudos to you for being willing to share that. I know a lot of the cases you cover are, but this is the first one you're kind of in the middle of.
It really is. Yeah. The death that I'm investigating is, is somebody I knew, and it happened, that summer where I was working, and it's very personal. And I talk, in some ways it's kind of an autobiography in some weird ways. There was one serial abuser at camp, and he was actually in charge of, child safety for this Pipestone organization. And, so he was, the one that was trying to train people to stay away from people like him. And I'm 17 years old. I'm not, I'm a kid, but I'm not naive.
Right.
But he was still able to talk me and six other boys into a sweat lodge that summer, in which we got totally naked and sat around the sweat lodge. And then when, you get covered in soot. And afterwards, he hung a shower, one of those gravity showers, off the back of his creepy, mystery machine camper van.
Yeah.
And held it up while we each, cleaned ourselves. And he was totally like, I'm 90% sure he videotaped us that day. Because when he eventually, and he's kind of connected to the central mystery that opens up when I'm researching this book, he ends up dying too of what I believe was a murder, but was also ruled a suicide. So it gets kind of nutty. Oh, and when he died, the police found all these videotapes in his house. And so I had to reach out to the police. I'm like, am I on one of those? And they're like, don't worry. We had those tapes destroyed, back, 15 years ago when this happened. So, who knows?
Were you appreciative that they were destroyed, or did it bother you that that evidence is gone if something does come up?
Well, I don't know what that evidence could be used for, other than to somehow get leaked at this point. So I'm happy that they were destroyed. I'd rather not know for sure.
That is intense, man. And that is going to be such a good book. Any plans on doing audiobooks for that? Or
yeah, for sure. So they've allowed me to do my audiobooks since True Crime Addict. So I've done the nonfiction, and I also write fiction, and hopefully I'm getting back to that. But the nonfiction I'll do the audiobooks for. So I think people like, there are so many people that get their true crime through podcasts like yours, right, that they're used to hearing our voices. So I think it works very well for nonfiction. With my fiction, I let somebody else do it because I don't do voices, So when I have a female character, I'm not like Mrs. Doubtfire. Hello.
that is a good Mrs. Doubtfire.
That was so solid.
So I can't do voices, but it works with the nonfiction. And so I'll do the audiobook for Scout Camp and, the true crime books as they come out.
Incredible. And thank you so much for talking about that.
You bet.
That's going to be such a good one.
I'm happy to start with you guys. I'm nervous that it's on the horizon and it's a story I'm going to have to talk about more and more and get comfortable talking about. A lot of these books, I'll do, when a new true crime book comes out, a lot of libraries will contact me and they're like, hey, can you come to our library and talk about this and give us a presentation for like an hour? But these library talks are a way for authors to make money and promote the book, and we sell books. But I can't see going into a library and talking about this book. It's not that kind of book. So
right.
I imagine I'm fine with, you know, I imagine I'll do lots of podcast talks about the Boy Scouts like this, but I certainly won't be promoting it the way I've promoted the other books.
When that day comes and you would like to come on again to talk even more about it, we'd love to have you on.
Oh, great. Great. Well, yeah. Well, next time we're on, we'll have to get into the ways in which we might help the victims of some of this past trauma. And there's a chapter in there where I explore that idea and end up taking mushrooms with a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. So we'll talk about that.
Greatest teaser of all time.
Part two, mushrooms in
DC.
Well, we'll put links to the book, to your website, and to the Porchlight Project. You also have a weekly podcast. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, the best place is just jamesrenner.com, and that'll give you links to the books and the podcasts. And yeah, True Crime This Week is my weekly podcast, comes out every Friday morning wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. James, we really appreciate it. Thanks, and we'll do this again.
Thank you so much. Yeah, anytime, guys.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.